There are so many questions that raises. One is like the depth of engagement.
Yes.
A lot of people, for example, say, all right, I want to help, so I will bake a cake for the church bazaar.
Yes.
Or I'll go and work at the clothing sale for the local community children's fund or something like that. The quality, and often they end up in a social situation that doesn't feed something very deep in them. And I'm curious about what kind of inner work would allow them to get in connection with a deep enough quality of compassion to, or a deep enough quality of reflecting with about the meaning of life to profoundly engage them.
Well, I think that's where we talk about spiritual practice. That spiritual practice is tremendously valuable to anyone at any age, actually. But it seems to be more obvious as we grow older that we need to find a sense of inner peace that will allow us to really seek out those situations which are truly nourishing and truly satisfying to us. Ways in which we can express our gratitude, our compassion, and really feel connected to other people in the world. And that requires a deepening of awareness, going within and recognizing that we really are connected. And I don't know any way to do that other than to take up some kind of practice, whether it's meditation or prayer or something that shifts attention from the outer world to the inner world. And that it's that connection when we feel that the inner and the outer are no longer split or separated, that we feel a greater sense of satisfaction with what we do in the outer world. That as long as we feel that there's a disparity between the inner and the outer, that then there's going to be some kind of conflict and discomfort. But the deepening of the inner work is usually what has been neglected in our society. Our society is so oriented to being in the outer world. We're extroverts as a culture. Culture is extroverted, that we often neglect inner work. And in psychotherapy, that's what we're doing essentially, is remedial work, because we don't appreciate the value of inner experience and paying attention to inner experience in our educational system, for example. And perhaps, you know, it's all we can do to learn to cope with the outer world. But if we don't pay attention to our inner experience, then I think we create suffering for ourselves and for others. But we do need to do that.
For people to wake up to themselves, often something of an awakening, like the bells we're hearing, for example.
Yes.
Awaken people to remember their inner work.
Yes.
And I guess that's what ritual is about.
Ritual and celebration, I think, are both very important in our lives. They do remind us of something. And, you know, we often speak of the ring of truth, and it's as though bells remind us, just if we tune in and listen to the sound, we shift consciousness in a way, just as we shift our consciousness when we are able to quiet the mind and listen to the silence. So at first, we need things like music and dance and song and bells to remind us of that other dimension of consciousness. And then in time, as we learn to appreciate the silence, the depth of the silence, then that too becomes a reminder of who and what we really are.
It's interesting because you can say those bells are noise that are interfering, or you can say, as Thich Nhat Hanh or somebody else would say, or in Huxley's Island, the bells, the awakening bell, the be here now, remind you, remember, remember, come alive, you know, don't sleepwalk through life.
Right, it's attention.
It's attention, it's attention.
Yeah, calling attention.
Calling attention to this moment.
Yes.
Just this moment. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, okay, we look at ritual. When we go back or go to what you were just talking about people, when somebody gives up a certain strategy and role in life and they're older, they often, like the statement, old dogs teaching old dogs new tricks, something like that. there is a kind of a reticence or a kind of a tension about the vulnerability of new investments and new games and new dances in life. And when they come to therapy, they are often dealing with what they perceive as pathology in themselves,
mm-hmm.
that the despair or the depression or the confusion or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you were alluding to new alternatives for people, but I'm trying to figure out that transition moment so that the transition doesn't have to go through somebody necessarily. See, it's like what they've been doing with single-minded purpose, like a business person or a mother or something, they have therefore, in order to value what they were doing, in a certain way they trivialized other aspects of their life.
Yes.
And now when that's the primary thing is taken away, they are left with only the trivial and themselves feeling trivial by, like, go to work in your garden.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Well, I work a little in my garden. But it's not like, now I can work in my garden.
Yes.
And, you know, you hear that issue. And
yes.
I'm trying to figure out the transitions, not through the vehicle of pathology.
Well, I think it's a matter of the evolution of self-concept. That's what I would say, that we derive our identity at certain stages in our lives from our roles, from our social roles, from our work, or from our relationships. For example, if I derive my identity only from being a mother to my children, then when they leave home and start their own families, I may feel bereft. And so I need to then discover what do I feel is a deeper source of identity that doesn't change with time. And for me, that's a shift from being identified primarily with the ego to being more identified with the soul. It's that sense of we're all on a soul's journey. And yesterday I was just listening to someone who was saying, if we could only ask ourselves each day, what have I learned about myself today, and what have I learned about other people today? We would begin the process of awareness that opens the door to a new appreciation of the depth of love and caring that can come really from the soul, and that we would be less preoccupied with our sense of ego identity and more in touch with a deeper, more meaningful and more valuable sense of participation in this life in a way that is truly significant and does contribute to the well-being of others. Because other people also want to be touched in that way. Other people want to be reminded of their soul's purpose. Everyone has some awareness of that depth, even though it may be hidden behind their preoccupations or their addictions or their difficulties in life. They may be struggling with situations that they feel don't allow them to go inward and touch that deeper place. But I think that when we can open that door, it has a tremendously healing effect. And then people can get in touch with what they truly want to be doing, not from an ego place, but from a soul place.
Mm-hmm.
So
what happens to staying with aging for a moment, when people begin to deal with things like slowing down, with less energy to feel wanting to involve themselves, there's a tendency to feel loss at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what other options are there, in a way, for a person at that point?
Well, I think that slowing down allows us to appreciate the moment more. I remember when I was a lot younger going to meditation retreats where we were supposed to slow down and how hard it was. It was a challenge, and it's gotten easier over the years and more enjoyable. And that sense of pacing one's life in accordance with whatever level of energy is available, and that changes, but it doesn't mean it's better or worse, it's just different. And so that sense of being willing to appreciate where one is at each stage. And on the other side, it may sound paradoxical, but one is to accept the slowing down and give more attention to what this present moment, the richness of this present moment. And the other would be to be willing to engage in new learning, because the research shows that old brains do learn, and they grow and they change, and so that new learning is incredibly stimulating, and that nowadays, again, with all the new communications technology and all the information that's available, new learning can continue up until any age, and that's seems to be the key to a sense of aliveness and relevance and engagement in the world. So I think that lifelong learning is very important for our willingness to feel better about ourselves at any age.
I just hear in the way you're saying that, and I feel myself saying yes, of course, like Heschel says, begin, always be the mind that's beginning or something like that. But I see a lot of older people that join things like Elder Hostel courses, but they are in part of it is a little hysteria of collecting information.
Mm.
And the kind of learning that I think we're talking about is a little different than that. And I think it's a little confusing to use the word learning, because, like, to learn calculus, I'm sure it's great fun for people, and it is stimulating and it keeps them alert and alive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that's what the game of age is, of the real work of aging is. And I want to see if that distinction can come through.
I think that's an important distinction. I'm glad you brought it up, because I think that it's a deeper learning that I think is most valuable. It's a spiritual learning that's most important, I think. It's something that allows us not only to expand our range of skills or interests, but something that allows us to deepen our awareness. It's self-knowledge is probably the most important task, I think, and that when we're no longer distracted by the demands of the external world, we have the opportunity to turn attention to self-knowledge, which, after all, the perennial wisdom says that that's what we should pay attention to all along, is to know ourselves. And so we have the opportunity for deeper spiritual practice, spiritual knowledge, deepening our inner life that is a precious gift. And it's wonderful, I think, that now we have that time when the demands of the outer world are less, that we can deepen our spiritual awareness.
It may be that who you are is somebody who you've always been, so that you've always been a soul looking at the dance of your ego. But it may have been that at some point you were more ego-identified.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me an example of what that transition looks like in terms of from inside, when you're identified with ego versus when you're identified with soul?
Well, when I'm identified with ego, I'm concerned about whether a book that I've written is going to sell a lot of copies, or whether somebody is going to give it a good review. My ego is very concerned about how it will be received in the world. My soul knows that once it's written, it's finished. It's done. I've been willing to do that work and to offer it to the world, and it doesn't matter how it's received. My part is done. My part has been to simply be willing to express what I had to say and what I felt I needed to say, because I'd learned so much from the people that I've worked with, so that there would be a very different sense about writing a book and offering it to the world. From the soul point of view, the work is done as soon as the book is finished. From an ego point of view, the ego still wants to know if anybody's going to read it and what they're going to think about it.
So how does the soul look at that component of the ego?
With humor, I think.
With humor.
Yes, it's just letting it be. You know, it doesn't matter. And it reminds me of Carl Sagan's talking about us all being so preoccupied with our self-concern on this little speck of dust in a rather insignificant galaxy in a vastness of space. I think that shift in perception is very helpful, to remember that You know, it doesn't matter at all. 100 years from now, everybody will have forgotten about it anyway. So it's a letting go of self-preoccupation, I think, that happens when we're willing to make that shift from ego to soul.
Do you think the soul lives more in the moment than the ego does, in terms of time?
Well, hopefully. I think that that as we increase awareness of soul, that that awareness and that awareness deepens, I think we can reach a state of consciousness which is timeless, which is, in a sense, outside of space-time, which is formless. It's another awareness which is very hard to talk about.
What is your device for moving from when you're caught in time back into timelessness?
Well, I have there's one exercise that I often suggest to people, which is to just think about a long time, and then think about a longer time, and an even longer time, and double that. And then when you think about eternity, think about your life. And it's a shift in perspective which allows us to maybe take it a little more lightly and recognize that we're only here for a very short time. And so perhaps we've been given so much in terms of the beauty in life, all of the beauty of nature. What an incredible blessing. What an incredible gift to be here. And so I think it shifts from self-preoccupation to gratitude, to appreciation. And this is something I've learned from working with people who perhaps are getting ready to die, maybe with a terminal illness, or they're coming to the end of their lives. And it's as though when we really wake up, we begin to see the preciousness of life, the beauty of life, and see the possibilities of expressing love, of giving and receiving love, and that the kingdom of heaven is spread on the earth, but we don't see it.
That's very nice. Thank you. A pleasure.
Thank you.